Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. Kerry to visit Britain in post-Brexit turmoil. Aftershocks from Britain's stunning decision to leave the European Union continued today as the country's politics and its relations with the world plunged into deeper uncertainty. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, already in Europe, added previously unannounced stops in London and Brussels to his trip at the last minute. Kerry plans to meet with British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond and other officials as part of a process of maintaining ties with Washington's top ally in a new era when Britain is less engaged with Europe. Foreign ministers of the European Union's six founding members, Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, met in Berlin to formulate a response to the vote in Britain to leave the EU. While European integration has taken a blow, the EU's core members insist it will not be fatal. Frank-Walter Steinmeier is the German foreign minister. He speaks through an interpreter.
Es muss uns jetzt die Möglichkeit gegeben werden.
We want to have the opportunity now to take care of Europe and its future. That means, after the decision Great Britain made, negotiations on a British exit or Brexit should begin as soon as possible.
Iraqi forces have liberated the city of Fallujah from Islamic State fighters following a month-long military offensive to seize control, according to a senior Iraqi official. Lieutenant General Abdul Wahab al-Sahadi said today, Fallujah is now fully liberated after Iraqi forces took control of Julan neighborhood, the last area of the city still held by ISIS. The destruction of the city is extensive. We invite you to visit our website anytime at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Officials in eastern Afghanistan say security forces have killed more than 135 Islamic State militants, including top commanders, and wounded many more in days of ground and air raids near the border with Pakistan. Regional civilian and security chiefs said the clashes in Nangarhar province's Khat district subsided today, but search and clearing operations are still underway. Authorities in Somalia say a terrorist siege of a Mogadishu hotel has ended, but not before at least 20 people were killed, including a government minister. The militant group Al-Shabaab is claiming responsibility for the attack. Somalia's foreign minister says among the dead is the country's environment minister, Buri Mohammed Hamza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank have gone without water in recent weeks. Abdel Farah Salim is one of them.
We come here and then we have to carry the water on our shoulders for a long distance. Those who can't afford to pay for a car to drive them are in trouble. They only have their shoulders.
An Israeli spokesman says there is exactly the same amount of water on the Israeli side, but there is better management of the water. He said Palestinians are stealing water directly from the pipes. Residents in storm-battered rural West Virginia have begun digging out from historic floods that killed at least 23 people and devastated entire communities with landslides and mudslides. Authorities are braced for more fatalities as search teams fan out over the area. Tim Parsons, a West Virginia pastor, says what he and his church are trying to do for the thousands who've lost their homes.
All you can do is give people a hug, a shoulder to lean on, and some food in their belly and some things that they need for the moment and try to show them the love.
President Barack Obama declared that a major disaster exists in the state's hardest-hit areas, the southeastern counties of Greenbrier, Kanawha, and Nicholas. The White House said federal aid includes grants for temporary housing and home repairs, as well as low-cost loans to cover uninsured property losses. The statement said additional money will be earmarked for aid to individuals and business owners hit by the disaster. Two new U.S. political surveys today show Democrat Hillary Clinton with a growing advantage in the U.S. presidential contest over her Republican challenger Donald Trump, but they differed in the extent of her lead. And Panama officially opened an addition to its sea canal today for a new generation of super cargo ships, capping a nine-year, $5.4 billion expansion project that will double shipping capacity and impact global trade routes. The Panamanian president unveiled the refurbished canal as the giant container ship Costco Shipping Panama made its way through a string of locks. Various foreign dignitaries, including the presidents of Taiwan, Chile, and several Central American nations, attended. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Police service was going to be very neutral, as you put it, positively neutral, and impartial in the discharge of our duty. And that is what the service has been doing over the years.
The Ghanaian police chief promises to ensure officers remain neutral during the November elections.
What I'm saying is that the government of the Republic of South Sudan, the president of the republic, is committed to the implementation of the agreement.
A South Sudanese official denies President Salva Kiir is to blame for renewed fears that the recent peace accord could be in danger.
3-4 years into your disease, if you saw the wheelchair imminent in your future and someone offered you an alternative, you might consider it.
And Canadian doctors succeed in getting patients with aggressive form of multiple sclerosis out of wheelchairs. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama plans to visit Liberia early this week to highlight girls' education. For more on Mrs. Obama's visit, VOA's James Batty, who is on assignment in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, joins us live via telephone link up. Hello, James.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening to Africa and all of your listeners.
How are you doing in Monrovia today?
Fantastic, fantastic. For the past 2 days, it's been raining in Monrovia. Of course, as you know, this is rainy season in Liberia. But today, it's been very sunny, but very humid.
Now, James, let me ask you this. Are Liberians ready for First Lady Michelle Obama's visit beginning tomorrow, Monday?
Exactly so, Peter. I think Liberians have been looking forward to Mrs. Obama's visit with great anticipation. As you know, I've been in this city now, in this country, for almost half a week, and everyone is eagerly awaiting Mrs. Obama's arrival tomorrow in the capital city, Monrovia, where I am based. The media, and I would say thank God to what I would call a proliferation of radio stations and newspapers. The media has been talking about the First Lady's trip. Unfortunately, she is not Mrs. Obama. The people in Greater Monrovia may not get to see Mrs. Obama because she is not coming to Monrovia proper, meaning that where the president is based, where the executive mansion is based, because she will not come through here, and the people here are not going to have the chance to see her. Although we are told that the government here had asked or had urged that the First Lady should come to Monrovia proper, but she's not going to be coming through here.
Was there any particular reason why she's not coming or visiting Monrovia, the capital? Because we understand she's supposed to meet the First Lady, as the President as well.
Of course, I think we are told that if the President, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, may be traveling to the Roberts International Airport to meet the First Lady. Well, what we understand is that I think Mrs. Obama is only spending at least 5 or 6 hours in Liberia, and as a result, she will not be able to come this way. When she arrives, I think she goes to Kakata. Kakata is a province about 30 or 45 miles from Monrovia, where the U.S. Peace Corps has its training and programming facility, where she is supposed to meet there and meet with people working there. The Peace Corps that come to Liberia are trained at that particular facility before they are sent to their different locations around the country. From Kakata, and Mrs. Obama will return back to the place called Unification Town. That's nearer to the international airport, where she is supposed to meet with girl students, adolescent students, school RS Caulfield High School.
James, let me ask you this. How ready are Liberians to welcome her, particularly when it was announced that she was making a visit to the country? And although some people are disappointed that she might not necessarily visit Monrovia proper, if I may put it that way.
I think, as I said, Peter, the Liberians are ready. The ordinary person is ready. As I said again, the newspapers, there are lots of newspapers in this country, and there are lots of radio stations since I arrived. I've been listening to lots of talk shows, and these talk shows have tried to tell the population about the First Lady's visit. This is really, I did have a chance to talk with the Minister of Education, and the fact that the U.S. First Lady is coming to highlight girls' education is very important to Liberians here, because as the Minister of Education told me, the girls in Liberia are most often shortchanged when they come to access to education and retention when they get into school. So they see this as a very important visit. Although she may not be coming to the center, the Monrovia Center, it is still an important visit for the people here.
Thank you very much, James. That was VOA's James Batty. He joined us live from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. The Ghanaian Inspector General of Police, John Kudalo, says officers will be positively neutral in the upcoming November general election. Kudalo spoke at the official opening of the recently held National Police Command Conference. The focus of the conference was to ascertain the preparedness of the police before the polls. Sefas Arthur, the police spokesman, told me that officers have discharged their mandate fairly by enforcing the law irrespective of the political party in power.
The police service was going to be very neutral, as you put it, positively neutral, and impartial in the discharge of our duty. And that is what the service has been doing over the years, at least ever since the inception of the Fourth Republic, that is since 1992. The police service has remained neutral, and we have discharged our mandate to the best of our abilities and to the admiration of the entire public.
During previous elections, the police always seem to have training for those officers who are deployed to the polling stations. Will this year be the same?
Exactly so. This year is going to be the same, and if possible, more than that, because the National Election Security Task Force, which is the body that oversees the security arrangement for the election, has been inaugurated earlier than usual. This particular year, the National Election Security Task Force was inaugurated on 20th January, quite earlier than other election years when it is usually inaugurated in June or July. And as part of the preparation towards the election, a series of orientation, training programs and seminars have been lined up to bring personnel of the service up to speed with modern trends of protecting or policing elections. Already, a few have taken place. Personnel who are going to be assigned to the flag bearers and their running mates have already been given a 3-week orientation in their mandate. And that orientation ended yesterday, and the IGP did indicate that. There are others lined up for the general police populace who are going to provide general security for the elections. And we are going to do these things, this with our stakeholders, DIFD, and other agencies. And so as for the training program, it is number one on our agenda.
Often the police personnel have been accused of being biased for one party or the other, depending on the circumstances. How do you train these, your officers, to ensure impartiality and to ensure that, despite accusations, they would discharge their mandate without fear or favor?
Oftentimes, these allegations are baseless. If you sat down and you listen to what those allegations were grafted on, you realize that they were baseless. Nonetheless, the police has, as the IGP indicated, is going to be positively neutral and is going to be impartial. And how do you become impartial? How do you become positively neutral? We become so when we are professional. We adhere to the tenets of our calling, of our profession, to remain neutral. And once you adhere to the tenets of the profession, you are 100% likely to be neutral and to be impartial. And that's what we are going to adhere to. Let me also say that the immediate past general election, that is the 2012 general election, was about near perfect as far as security was concerned. And that, in the aftermath, the hullabaloo that was generated in the aftermath of the election, no finger was raised against security. All the parties claimed the performance of the police a sterling one. And so I can assure you that we are committed to repeating the same and even doing better. And we cannot afford not to do it better, because over the years we have garnered the experience, the necessary experience, to even improve upon our art.
Seif Azatha is the spokesman for the Ghanaian police. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The South Sudanese Information Minister has denied media reports that President Salva Kiir has refused to sign resolutions of the consensus reached 3 weeks ago to establish cantonment sites for the forces of the armed opposition faction under the command of his first deputy, Riek Machar. This after Festus Mohai, former Botswana president, tasked to oversee and monitor the full implementation of the peace accord, expressed disappointment and called on President Kiir to honor his commitment. But Information Minister Michael Makuei told me Kiir is not to blame for the delays in establishing the cantonment sites.
Well, of course, I don't know what is the problem of Festus Mohai. I'm a member of JAMEC and he talks anyhow. Anyway, that is not the issue. But what I'm saying is that the government of the Republic of South Sudan, the President of the Republic, is committed to the implementation of the agreement. What is happening is that the delay in the establishment of the cantonment areas is the lack of resources. Also had promised to fund the cantonment, have not released a penny. They have not released a penny. And this is why it is difficult up to this moment to establish the cantonment, because it's not a question of saying you sit under that tree and that is all. So the problem is with even he himself, he is supposed to talk to the international community so that they fund the cantonment areas. He has not been doing it. Not that only, but even he himself is in own crisis, because even JAMEC itself is not funded.
What,
the agreement is silent about the funding of who will do the funding. For the government of South Sudan, we have, as you know very well, we have our own financial crisis. And nevertheless, we are trying our level best to ensure that the peace agreement is implemented. But for him to go to the air and start pointing an accusing finger to everybody, then he should also, that pointing should include himself, because I'm sure the JAMEC is not doing its job as well. The members of the international community who committed themselves to fund the peace agreement have not done anything up to now.
So Mr. Makuei, the problem now is the issue you said of funding. So without the funding, the cantonment areas or the establishment thereof as critical part of the full implementation of the peace agreement will not be able to go on?
No, that is not the case, because the implementation is moving in other areas. But the issue is that at present, even the CITESAM and the JMCC, which is supposed to go and see the cantonment areas, the agreed cantonment areas, has not gone up to now, because it is not in a position to move.
Mr. Makuei, the presidency, as we are being told by report, also failed to agree on terms of reference for the 15-member committee to review the number of states in the country, which they said further delays to form the committee. What do you say to that?
The parties, the three, the president and his two vice presidents, when he sat with them, they agreed to establish a committee. The terms of reference have been referred to a body to draft them. So this idea, I don't know where did you get that report that they have disagreed on the terms of reference. I'm sorry, terms of reference have not yet been brought, and when they go to them, they will look into it.
Critics are saying that advisors of the president who are anti-peace are behind the latest move, and that is what is getting President Salva Kiir not to sign and move the process.
I think your government, your question is from a source which is anti-government. Advisors of the president are not anti-peace in the first place. They are people to advise the president on how best he can run the affairs of the nation. That is what they do. They are not anti-peace, and if there is anybody who has reported to you that they are anti-peace, that person who reported that is the anti-peace. So there is no question of they misadvising the president. If the presidential advisers were anti-peace, the president would have not kept them.
What assurances will you give the people of South Sudan following all these reports that the president, and for that matter, the government, is committed to the full implementation of the peace agreement?
Well, what I can say is that I can assure the people that the transitional government of national unity is committed to peace, and it is working in harmony and peace. And peace is already achieved, and we are in the process of implementing the agreement as one team. So all those issues which are being raised as people who are anti-peace and so forth, I think these are people who are anti-peace who are raising such accusations and charges.
Michael Makuei is the South Sudanese Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Turning to Southern Africa, the deteriorating Zimbabwean economic situation has given rise to protests. In the third largest city of Mutare, hundreds of supporters of the opposition Movement for Democratic Change Party marched in protest against the poor state of the economy, demanding an explanation from President Robert Mugabe. The protesters declared that there will be much more freedom demonstrations until President Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party address the crippling economic challenges. For VOA, reporter Lloyd Hamoyu has details from Mutare.
The peaceful demonstration comprising of about 3,000 protesters started from Sakuva Beto through to the central business district, says Mikros Park. Traffic came to a visual standstill as the demonstrators braved the nearly 5-kilometer protest march. Ms. Kupe later addressed the gathering at around lunchtime, stating that the protests would be held in some parts of the country after holding others in the capital and in Bulawayo.
Today, as Zimbabwe, we find ourselves in an extraordinary situation. Extraordinary situations require extraordinary measures. We have and we will continue to invoke Section 59 of the Zimbabwe Constitution, which guarantees our right to demonstrate against failures of Mugabe and ZANU-PF.
Oh, yes. Amen.
Kupe said citizens have to be prepared to make sacrifices until there is real change that ends ZANU-PF corruption and poverty induced on people through poor governance policies.
Let us fight with the last drop of our tears. Let us fight with the last drop of our sweat. Enough is enough. Zwakwana, zwakwanele. We will continue to demonstrate until Mugabe and ZANU-PF go packing to Zimba. As the MDC, our fundamental promise to the people of Zimbabwe is a better life for all. We hereby, as the MDC, demand that they be changed.
Zimbabweans demand to know the whereabouts of $15 billion in diamond revenue from Chiatswa diamond fields that the ZANU-PF-led government cannot account for. She added that, despite the 2.2 million jobs promised by the ZANU-PF party during its election campaigns in 2013, there has been more unemployment and company closures. Mr. David Tekeshe was among the thousands of demonstrators. He says he supports the democratic path being taken of peaceful protests for regime change.
The president is democratic. He wants democratic means to remove Mugabe and his people. So we applaud him. And I think that's the way forward. We don't want war, but we want to show them democratically, as the president said.
James Mdenda, Mutare resident, says Mr. Tsvangirai's message was very clear to every Zimbabwean who needs political change that benefits every Zimbabwean.
The message was quite clear to every Zimbabwean
it is actually telling the situation on the ground. The message was talking about the closure of industry. The message was talking about the bond notes, which everybody in Zimbabwe is having questions about. The message was talking about Mugabe's promises, thousands and or millions of promises, which have never been realized. So Zimbabweans today were gathered at Mikko's Park to ask Mugabe what he has promised, especially the 2 million jobs, which are not there.
Jobless university graduate Chennai Mangezi from Chipinge says the statement from the MDC leader breathed the lease of life to the dejected citizenry, particularly the youths.
It was a very powerful speech because he needed us as youth for us to be aggressive enough against the Zanu PF government.
The MDC deputy president was accompanied in Mutare by other top party leaders, including Abednego Bebe, Obed Gutu, Porina Mpariwa, Teresa Makoni, Morgan Komichi, Giles Mtsekwa, Douglas Mwanzura, among other provincial chairpersons from across the country. MDC's Manicaland provincial spokesperson Trevor Sarwaka said the demonstration ended peacefully without any arrests or disturbances. Similar protests have already been made in Harare and Bulawayo. In Mutare, this is Lloyd Damoyo.
And Canadian doctors have succeeded in getting patients with an aggressive form of multiple sclerosis, or MS, out of wheelchairs and moving again. It's a potential game changer in the treatment of MS, but as VOA's Jessica Berman reports, the protocol is risky and is being closely watched by other neurologists.
Multiple sclerosis is the leading crippler of young adults, with an estimated 2.3 million people around the world affected by the neurological disease. At its root, MS is an immune disorder. The body's immune system mistakenly attacks the fatty outer layer of brain neurons called myelin, a situation that over time can lead to paralysis. But what if the immune system can be completely replaced? Would that stop its assault on the patient's central nervous system? That's in essence what Canadian researchers at the University of Ottawa asked and answered. Neurologist Mark Friedman is a senior scientist at the Ottawa Hospital and a professor at the university. He says for their experiment, begun in 2001, investigators identified a group of 24 patients with an extremely aggressive form of MS.
3-4 years into your disease, if you saw the wheelchair imminent in your future, and someone offered you an alternative, you might consider it. And so that's the kind of population we went after. And one could argue, and this is what some of our critics said, oh, you'll never be able to treat those patients because even if you made a little dent in the amount of activity they had, they're still going to go on. They're very resistant to treatment.
Researchers describing their work in the journal The Lancet use strong chemotherapy drugs to completely destroy the patient's immune systems. At the same time, they collected stem cells from the patient's bone marrow, purified them, and eventually transplanted the cells back into patients to repopulate their immune system.
Theoretically, the brand new immune system no longer carries that memory, whatever it caused it, we still don't know, but it won't have that same problem again and will no longer attack the nervous system.
The results were as breathtaking as they were unexpected, according to Friedman.
2 and 3 years after the transplant, many of the patients who had significant disability started to recover, and recovered quite a bit. So we had patients who were already walking with a cane, go back to a life where they're working, they're skating, they're skiing, they're running, they're doing everything.
In 15 years of observation, Friedman says he's never seen the disease return, but he also cautions that the study size of 24 patients is very small, and in the short term, the procedure is too risky to become common treatment for MS. Paul Wright is chief of neurology at North Shore University Hospital in Long Island, New York. He finds the results very encouraging, but agrees doctors should move cautiously.
I mean, a large amount of the patients had febrile illnesses where they developed fevers from infections.
In Wright's opinion, more studies need to be done, even though in Canada, Mark Friedman's group has now treated an additional 20 MS patients. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football, with the draws for the qualifiers for the 2018 World Cup. In the draw held in Cairo on Friday, there are five groups of four teams, with only the winners of each group making it to the tournament in Russia. It's the final round of qualifying, which follows two previous knockout rounds and will kick off in October. Matches continue in November, and there will be a further four rounds during 2017 between August and November. Four big names were drawn together in Group B, with Cameroon, Nigeria and Algeria, who have all been at the past two World Cup finals, placed alongside 2012 Africa Cup of Nations winners Zambia. Cameroon have appeared at the tournament seven times, more than any other African country, but have suffered in recent years and could struggle in what looks to be the toughest of all the groups. Algeria, the highest-ranked side on the continent, were among the top seeds for the draw, with Nigeria included in the second seed. Neighbours Libya and Tunisia were paired in Group A. Libya's last international match against Morocco in June was hosted by Tunisia because of ongoing security issues in the North African country. Group E could shape up to be a fight between heavyweights Ghana and Egypt. The Black Stars have appeared at the last three finals, but Egypt have not qualified since 1990. These are the five groups. In Group A, there's Tunisia, Libya, DR Congo and Guinea. Group B has Zambia, Cameroon, Algeria and Nigeria. Group C has Gabon, Mali, Ivory Coast and Morocco. Group D has Senegal, South Africa, Burkina Faso and Cape Verde. And Group E has Ghana, Egypt, Congo and Uganda. Meanwhile, Algeria's Entente Setif have been ejected from the African Champions League after trouble marred their match with Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa. The game on June 18th was abandoned by the referee, with Sundowns two goals up when violence broke up in the stands. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has now thrown Setif out of the tournament and annulled the result of the match, which could damage Sundowns' chances of making it out of the group. They lose the points and the goals which they had gained in the victory. CAF has also left open the possibility of further sanctions against Setif. The other teams in the group are Enyimba of Nigeria and Egypt's Zamalek, who top the now three-team group after a 1-0 away win in the first round of the matches. Still in South Africa, South Africa geared up for the upcoming appearance at the Olympic Games with a morale-boosting success in the COSAFA Castle Cup on Saturday, winning the title with a 3-2 victory over Botswana in the final in Windhoek. A disputed penalty in the last 3 minutes handed the under-23 team the title in the annual South African Championship, with the team using the tournament in Namibia to prepare for the Olympics in Brazil in August. It's the fourth time that South Africa have won the trophy, meaning they now share with Zimbabwe the mantle of the most successful side since the tournament was first introduced almost two decades ago. Talking of Rio Olympics, a reigning Commonwealth 100-meter champion, Kemar Bayle-Cole, claims he has been diagnosed with the Zika virus. The 24-year-old Jamaican says he only learned of his condition after his girlfriend found a bump on his neck. Fears over Zika, which is linked to serious birth defects, has led to several golfers withdrawing from Rio 2016. The mosquito-borne virus has been declared a global public health emergency by the World Health Organization, although the body has said there's no need to move or postpone the games. Bailey Cole also won Olympic 4x100-meter gold alongside Usain Bolt at London 2012. The discovery comes as Bailey Cole is preparing for next week's Jamaican Olympic trials, where he'll face the likes of Bolt, Asaf Powell, and Johan Blake for a place in Rio. And that's all for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Yes.
Girl, I'm drowning in your love. Yeah. So baby, take it all. I know it's you, no turning back. Girl, I said it all. I don't care what people say about you. Don't care if they must spoil you for me. Because a good old lullaby, kuwewa. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubting I fit mess up too. Hasta mi ma bu. Oh, my girl, tell me my loco. Oh, no, go juro, my loco. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. Baby, oh, baby, oh, girl, I just want you to know. Grief another man bore you out, hey, baby. Don't go jump another woman, no how. Feeling I'm feeling for you, baby, is awakening my soul. I will love you till nobody else see what they won't do for you. Why? Yeah, you no go regret. Nothing gon' make me forget. Only you I no go to share. Cause a good old lullaby. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubting I fit mess up too. Hasta mi ma bu. You not to open me my no. Oh, no go to Roma, no. Yeah, go to Pocache, go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. Yes, yes. Baby, oh, girl, I just want you to know.
As I see your sexy face and your baby belly, girl, I have to change my ways. I tell you,
Give
up, I'm a girl, you carry belly for me. Give up, oh, you look fine, no more wrong. But then, your father is violent.
Oh, let me get low.
Jumbo, 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 we'll be fine, man, here.
Come on, guys.
Dumbo, I don't need soap no more. Amaka, you know, Bama Yoruba, let me know. If a papa no want us to marry, your woman, or you know. No, girl, I'm down for you, don't forget. The love I get for you, Mama, no go compare. Oh, As long as you love me, girl, I dare you. Yeah. Girl, I dare you. Girl, I dare you. Oh, lolo, fair, no more wrong. But then, your father is violent. Oh, let me dare you. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. Oh, you define that your mother is black belt. She's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I bet you better. Your father is violent. Oh, let me tell you. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. We'll be fine, mommy. Oh, my guy is black belt. She's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I don't get so no more.
says she likes it when I stay. She says she don't want me to go. She says I always make her day. Girl, would you be my lover? No. She says she really likes my style. Seems like she wants to take it slow. Do anything to make her smile. Girl, would you be my lover? No. What am I to do? Tired of running around chasing you. I can never think of replacing you. Cause now you are fine, baby, make up your mind. Hey, would you be my lover? All over for this guy is feeling it in my soul. So would you be my lover? No, I'm doing things I've never done. I'm giving all I have to give. I'm feeling like I found the one. Say you'll be my lover, please. What am I to say? Tired of running around, no delay. Make you no go look who Jay face. All this time you there waste, you gon' make me crazy. Would you be my lover? Magic cruise. Wonder if you go do. I got one question for you. Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Baby, oh.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. How over the last 3 weeks, we have had reports of armed clashes between Eritrean and Ethiopian forces in the Horn of Africa. And just last week, the government of Eritrea announced that it has information that Ethiopia is planning a massive attack on its territory. It also alleged that Ethiopia was acting under the guidance of Western powers who wish to have regime change in Eritrea. Of course, Ethiopia and United States and others have already denied these allegations. But we must also recognize that the failure by the United Nations and the African Union in preventive diplomacy may cause another major flare-up in the Horn of Africa. As it may be recalled, between 1998 and 2000, Eritrea and Ethiopia fought a bloody war over a tiny village, Badme. That war was established to have been caused by Eritrea that invaded the disputed territory. But what is significant is that at the end of that conflict, the matter was referred to the Eritrean-Ethiopia Boundary Commission that was set up by the United Nations. That Boundary Commission established that Badme belonged to Eritrea. Regrettably, Ethiopia failed to carry out the findings of the Boundary Commission, and the rest of the international community failed to apply the necessary pressure on Ethiopia to fulfill the ruling of the Boundary Commission. And why was that possible? By that time, Eritrea and its leader Afwerki had become pariah states and pariah president. And the UN, the African Union, and the rest of the international community allowed the issue to fester. Now it's understandable why this was done, because it was alleged that Eritrea was guilty of massive human rights violation. But this is not the way one has to go in terms of negotiations. Practitioners of negotiations know that preventive diplomacy is preferable to negotiations to end conflict. And the second Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, established in a famous speech at Oxford few months before he died in the Congo, that one should distinguish between neutrality and impartiality. No one is saying that one should not condemn Eritrea for its violation of human rights. But in terms of impartiality, pressure should have been applied on Ethiopia to comply with the ruling of the Boundary Commission. Now, this issue, which remains unsolved because Ethiopia is still occupying Badme and the territory, may lead to more human suffering. So to prevent further conflict, it is important that the United Nations and the African Union review that decision by Ethiopia not to comply with the Boundary Commission. One cannot expect that the issue will remain as it is. Failure to solve disputes often leads to armed conflict, and therefore an appeal has to be made that preventive diplomacy is preferable, and the United Nations and the African Union with the rest of the major powers to exercise their best efforts to resolve the underlying issue of Badme so we do not see another horrific war between these two countries in the Horn of Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. And as you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, tomorrow is pregnant. Who knows what it will deliver? I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The signing of the Paris Climate Change Agreement on April 22nd was a crucial step in the global effort to meet head-on one of the defining challenges of our time. Among other provisions, the agreement establishes a global framework to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and sets a goal of holding the increase in the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels and to pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. The Paris Agreement was a critical milestone, said Secretary of State John Kerry at a recent visit to Oslo, Norway. But everybody knows that what we did in Paris does not guarantee a cap on a 2 degrees centigrade rise in temperature. What does help reduce levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and therefore helps lower temperatures, are forests. Trees trap carbon dioxide and store it as they grow, but when they die, whether by logging or burning, they release the gas back into the atmosphere. That is why the United States and Norway signed an agreement to work together to help slow climate change through forest protection. Thus, the two countries pledged to, for example, strengthen their efforts to fight illegal logging. The more that governments like ours can do to reinforce the commitments that we made in Paris, the more we will amplify the message that was sent to all sectors of the globe, said Secretary of State Kerry.
Together with the help of partners around the world, we will better preserve the landscapes that provide not only food, fuel, the fibers that our communities need, but also the climate mitigation and resilience benefits that are absolutely critical to our future.
What we are doing here is helping to keep faith with Paris. It's helping to keep faith with common sense. And it's helping to keep faith with the best hopes and aspirations of people in our countries, said Secretary of State Kerry. I pledge the strongest possible support of the United States of America for actions that will safeguard our health and safeguard our planet for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.